Join the Betamax Video Club, rewinding back to our favourite films of the 1980s. My name's Rich Nelson. Today I've rented Pretty in Pink. Watching with me is Anita Singh. Hi Anita, how are you?
I'm very well, how are you?
I'm good, and thank you for bringing this Betamax copy of Pretty in Pink. It was a treat to revisit as certainly an older person than the teenager I probably was when I last watched. What's so special about Pretty in Pink for you?
This is my favourite film of all time. And sometimes when I say that to people, they're kind of like, but it's not really that good a film, is it? And I'm not saying it's the best film that's ever been made. It's probably not even the best film of 1986, is it? I mean, Top Gun came out in 1986, I think, and Stand By Me, various other things. It's not the best film, but it's my favourite film. And I think it's because it's that classic kind of girl meets boy and there's an obstacle in their way and are they going to snog in the end that you get in so many films. But every single character in it is brilliant. Every single line of dialogue in it is brilliant. And I think also it's kind of with 80s films, it's a bit like 80s music for people of my age. The reason why you love these films so much is because you watch it and it takes you back to the person that you were then and the emotions that you had then. And I think when it came out, I was maybe 12 or something like that. So I can't have watched it in the cinema. I must have got it out on video. And that's the sort of peak age of totally being in love with boys and wanting to go out on dates and dreaming of a prom, which is not something that we had in Britain at that time. But, you know, you saw them in these American films and they were so amazing. And so I watch it and I just get this rush of what it was like to be in your sort of early teens. And it just, every time I watch it, I get quite emotional.
It's understandable, really, because it's such a, I hate to use the word cliche about 80s films, but there was that high school thing and the prom at the end. And I mean, when I went to school, they kind of tried to implement something. I mean, we're talking home counties in the mid-90s, and it didn't work at all. I mean, it was during, I think, England were playing a World Cup game on that same evening. So, of course, they were gathered around the TV. Really well planned. And watching these films both at the time and now, you kind of realise, you know, that you got everything, you know, this prom and that whole finale to the film. But you know, the actual prom itself takes up such a small amount. It's all about the journey. And when you think, you know, it's easy to think if you haven't seen it for a while, it's, oh, it's a romantic, you know, which boy does she choose? And then, you know, much in the way that when I went back and watched Dirty Dancing and you suddenly realise, this isn't just some chick flick, you know, they're talking about abortions and class and all that sort of stuff. And watching this is all about picking, I'll say picking, like you have that luxury when you're a teenager, but picking someone and worrying about what people think about you because you've got money or you haven't. It's because she quite literally lives on the other side of the tracks.
With like the track literally outside her house and a train going past it, yeah.
It's like literally banging you over the head with it, just going. and kind of watching it now and you think about what they explored there. And it's fascinating to see, I guess, it's always interesting to put it into your own context about, you know, when you went to school and, you know, were you a jock or a nerd or were you somewhere in between? You had the rich kids and the poor kids.
Yeah.
Not so much at my school because I was very much the poor kid. You know, I mean, how was it like that at your school?
Was it? Well, I went to an all-girls school till I was 16.
Oh, wow.
Which I wouldn't advise anyone to send their children to because it just means that you are obsessed with boys. and that's part of the reason why I think we all loved films like this, because they were just this kind of unreachable, kind of amazing other species. Whereas if I'd actually been at school with 13-year-old boys, I would have realised that, you know, boys were actually terrible. But I think with a lot of John Hughes films, what he tapped into was, he understood teenagers really well. And what he tapped into was that really intense feeling you have when you're that age, that you really want to be different and you want to be special and you want to kind of stand out. But at the same time, you're desperate to fit in and you want to be like everyone else. And in this film, you know, Molly Ringwald, she's got no money. And Blaine is from this sort of clique where everyone's massively rich. And she doesn't want to be part of that. But at the same time, she's kind of envious of it. You know, she drives past the big house and she's like, oh my God, I wish I could live in a house like that. And so it's that sort of tension between wanting to be part of that group and wanting to be yourself that he was so brilliant at portraying, I think.
Yeah, and we, you know, obviously doing an 80s podcast, we've come across many of the films that either he's written or directed, and this is one that, I mean, I didn't, stupidly, I didn't actually realize he didn't direct this until yesterday.
No, it
And
was Howard Deutsch who
yeah,
directed this one, I think.
and Some Kind of Wonderful, just to kind of get himself into that little sort of alcove there. But
Yeah.
I mean, and you know, coming back, you know, obviously he did everything from Ferris Bueller to Planes, Trains and Automobiles, and we did one of the early episodes I did was The Breakfast Club, and on that, and I mean that came out before this, and yet you read, was it maybe 3 or 4 years ago, an essay that Molly Ringwald wrote about how uncomfortable she was on making that film with the issues with Judd Nelson
Yeah.
and the.
I mean, the hill that I will die on is that Pretty in Pink is a far superior film to The Breakfast Club. I know everyone loves The Breakfast Club, but Molly Ringwald kind of did hit on it. I think she wrote that when the Me Too thing was just starting, and saying that when she looks back at it, actually, what's his name? The character, John Bender, he's actually sort of quite creepy, and he's sexually harassing Molly Ringwald's character all the way through that film. And if you look back on it now, you're like, you know, it's enjoyable in a million ways. And the soundtrack is good, and the characters are good, and it's got Paul Gleason in it, who is always brilliant in everything. But it's slightly problematic when you look at it now. Whereas Pretty in Pink, I don't think it has any of those issues. I think it kind of stands the test of time.
Yeah, and when you think the kind of villain of the piece is James Spader, who is just the peak villain for anything from this era, it's absolute. I mean, everything about him, his hair is magnificent.
And also that, I mean, it's funny because he looks about 30 in this film, doesn't he? I think he was actually in his mid-20s, whereas Molly Ringwald was quite young, I think. But yeah, he steals this film, really.
And you know, again, doing my in-depth research, as in IMDb, and you read about how they wanted James Spader initially to play the character of Blaine, and you kind of think,
Yes.
when, and it's easy to look back now and think, thank God they didn't. But you know, he's so good as Steph, the kind of the friend, the very unsupportive, you know, uber rich, I say leader of, it's almost like leader of the T-Birds or something like that. But he's that real sadistic, almost, you know, ch making Blaine choose,
Yeah,
and
it's perfect.
you know, you can see him as he went on to become even richer and even more of a bastard. And yet Blaine, you know, the Andrew McCarthy, who he's just got this sort of soft, you know, Chandler from Friends hairdo and these oversized blazers and things. And again, you know, like we joke on a lot of these about how a lot of the times it's technology that dates a film, but this is very much the clothes.
It is the clothes, although with the technology, one of my favourite scenes in it is when they're in the school library and she's sitting in front of a computer and he sort of types this little message to her, and then a picture of her appears on the screen, and then it kind of turns into a picture of him. And I don't know if computers could do that then, or even if they could do that now. I just remember watching that and thinking it was the most amazing kind of technical thing I'd ever seen in my life.
I wonder if it's a John Hughes thing, because I guess, like, he's obviously doing weird science, and
Yeah.
Ferris Bueller was quite into computers as well, I think, wasn't he? So, is that obviously something he that when you say he taps into a teenager's mind, he obviously thought he was ahead of the game with computers. I mean, that was, I guess, you know, their version of, I don't know, MSN Messenger or Snapchat or something. I've never used Snapchat, I don't know. And I mean, one thing that I loved, because when I was at uni, I worked in Alprice on Holloway Road, and the
Oh,
fact
wow.
that they work in, and a lot of it is set around a record shop,
Yes.
tracks. It's just perfect, because even now you can look and you see, you know, a record shop, and yes, you know, remember them kids,
Yeah.
and you know, you see all the displays. I think there was a display for Spandau Ballet, some merchandise there, and all the vinyls in this. Oh, it just looked like heaven,
I
nostalgia
know, it's
heaven.
lovely, isn't it? And also, you know, her character, Molly Ringwald's character, is all the sort of rich kids think that she's really uncool, but actually look how cool she is. She works in that record shop. It's like the coolest job there is, right?
I think so. I mean, it was the 2 months that I worked at our price, and you
Well,
know,
how cool was our price? I don't know.
well, bear in mind, I read the book of High Fidelity while I was working there, and he worked in essentially this shop in the, you know, on Holloway Road.
Oh yeah, that's right.
That was a lot cooler, I think. I didn't have Jack Black working though, thankfully.
No, true.
And again, you know, when you look at it now, and there are the vinyls, there are the tapes, and I went into a record shop in Crouch End a couple of weeks ago, and they had tapes in there, and my eyes lit up. And I realised I had nothing to play them on, but that doesn't matter. And she's working in this record shop with Iona, who a lot of people recognise as Janine from Ghostbusters, but she's this kind of, I think she's in her sort of early 30s, reliving, you know, she's still trying to work out exactly what her identity is, but she doesn't care, and she's got these amazing hairstyles.
Yeah, and she has sort of different looks, and then the look that she goes for at the end is actually sort of slightly disappointing, because she's been sort of really out there and quirky all the way through, and then at the end she does this sort of Miami Vice kind of look, which at the time would have been sort of quite standard. So that was a little bit disappointing for me, I think.
Yeah, because her character arc, you know, she's like this sort of mentor to Andy, you know, very much giving her the advice and all the things that she did. And then when Andy goes to see her towards the end of the film to borrow her old prom dress to completely cut it up and sew up, she's there and she dresses like what you imagine Donald Trump would love his wife to look like. You know, there's a white blazer and with badges on,
sleeves rolled up.
And she's going out with this guy who's just, again, peak 80s with gelled hair and grey striped shirts. It is a sad shame.
Laugh and I'll deck you.
What happened?
Either it's all those drugs I took in the 60s, or I am really in love. What do you think? Honestly.
Honestly, I think you look great.
Oh, I look like a mother.
No. Well, yeah, a little, but that's okay.
Again, going through, you know, we talked about the issues at school, and I think this was filmed in the school that they filmed Grease in.
Oh, I did not know that. Good research.
Yeah, thanks, IMDb. I haven't seen Grease for ages. It says a lot. I probably prefer Grease 2. But they sort of, this stuff is school, and it is that what, when I went to secondary school, I mean, I went to secondary school in Potter's Bar, it's nothing like this. there's a, you know, with the lockers and the gyms, and everyone's sitting when they're in the gym class, and all they're in their sort of 80s garb, smoking and playing volleyball and stuff. There's nothing, it's not real, that can't be right. But,
I know, but that's what made it seem so exotic, isn't it? That you thought that really American high schools must be like that.
Yeah. None of the girls in my class looked like Gina Gershon. But, or maybe that was just the people I was hanging out with at the time.
Yeah, possibly. Yeah, yeah.
What we haven't talked about yet is Andy has this friend, Ducky, who is, I guess, if you were to look at a dictionary definition of being in the friend zone. This guy absolutely adores her in every way, and she treats him like a little brother or an annoying cousin or something like that. He is annoying though, isn't he?
He's kind of annoying, yeah. If you had him in your own life, you'd be changing your phone number, wouldn't you? And pretending you were out all the time. But I think a lot of other actors would have not been able to make that character lovable, but John Cryer just totally makes it brilliant.
If he just keeps it on that side of he's annoying but he's adorable in that
yes.
way.
And the ending of the film, which you probably know, was originally supposed to be Andy and Blaine didn't get together and she ended up at the prom reunited with Ducky. Not, I don't think, in a romantic way, but the two of them were together and it was like, look, the most important person in my life is this amazing friend who has stuck by me all the time. But the test audiences hated it. So they changed it and they reshot it all so that in the end, she ends up with Blaine. And Ducky gets this little kind of sort of comedy payoff at the end where the most beautiful woman in the whole room decides that she's really attracted to him, which is not that likely, but, you know, it is a nice ending for him.
Yeah, I mean, I'd read about this, you know, a few times, and then luckily it was on one of the iTunes extras, was they had a little 15-minute documentary thing at the end of it where they spoke to the director Molly Ringwald and John Cryer about the ending, and they had a couple of behind the scenes videos. They didn't show the actual ending, which I thought was a bit of a shame, but
yeah,
they showed them filming the ending. And basically they, Andy and Ducky, have this kind of moonlight dance in the middle of the prom. Everyone gathers around to watch them because, you know, everyone separates and leaves this enormous circle in the middle of the dance floor for them. And it looks, like you say, it's not that romantic thing, because she, you know, Molly Ringwald said, in even in this clip, they didn't have that chemistry.
Yeah.
Because I think initially Robert Downey Jr. was almost cast as Ducky, and she, you know, she was quite open about this. She said, basically, I fancied him. I didn't fancy John Cryer.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure John Cryer was sitting there, you know, you could almost see the moment where his heart breaks.
But you see, when these films first came out, obviously there was no Google, so you had you didn't really understand the background to things. So for years and years, I would watch this film and think, why has Andrew McCarthy got really bad hair in the prom scene of this film? And how come I've massively fancied him all the way through, and then at the end, he sort of looks a bit weird and his haircut is bad? And then eventually, when the internet was invented and I could read about it, it was that because they had to come back and reshoot this ending because people hadn't liked the original one, he had lost loads of weight for a role. He was playing, I think, a soldier or something like that on stage in New York, and he'd shaved all his hair off for it. But then they called him back. So he looks really gaunt. There's nothing they can do about that. And they made him wear this really terrible wig, which was the closest they could get to the hair he'd had all the way through. And I think he once described it as looking like a rodent on his head. And it really does. And so that slightly ruins the ending if you've loved Andrew McCarthy all the way through.
I think they even showed in that little clip a picture of him in the original ending and then him with the new ending with the new hair. And it's just weird. I mean, I know people like to, you know, go all out for the prom, but it looks like he's gone on an extreme diet.
Yeah.
And got into his dad's Just for Men cupboard or something like that. I mean, it's weird. I haven't talked, you know, test screenings are such a weird thing. And I've been to a couple, not through this or anything, but a few years ago, there used to be someone stood outside the Wimbledon Odeon with a clipboard.
Oh,
and,
really?
And you'd always, if you come out of a film, you'd always go over to the person with a clipboard and float around them and hope they'd invite you along to watch one of these.
And what did you see? Do you remember?
I saw the salmon fishing in the Yemen.
Yeah.
The boat that rocked and the remake of Footloose. I was getting the two mixed up. And they give you the cards and the scores at the end. And the thing is, I've not seen any of those films since.
Yeah.
So these films hadn't been finished. They had dodgy special effects and bits that, you know, you sit there. I mean, it's free, so you can't complain. But and at the end of the Footloose one, they invited certain people of obviously certain demographics into a focus group.
Right.
And I was there with my wife. I can't remember who married or not, but we were obviously the sort of couple in the early 30s. There were the two sort of female friends. There were the two quite camp guys. There were people of all these different diverse groups. And it's at the end of Footloose. And they said, oh, what did you think? And I thought, God, what are you going to ask me? Like, it's no Die Hard, is it? You know. And then I'm thinking, you know, should I go back and rewatch that and see if they added a bit at the end where they blow up the church or something like that, or the terrorists come and take over because some dickhead in Wimbledon said that it should have been more like Die Hard.
And was that a terrible film?
It was just too similar, but not as good. It was just weird.
I'm offended by the very idea that they tried to remake Footloose. So just out of principle, I would never watch it.
Yeah. And again, it's just like, well, what do we do? Okay, well, Dennis Quaid's old now, so we'll make him the dad. And I think that Miles Teller was in it. I think
The
Chris Penn role. I think I can't remember. And it was dreadful. But you think about, that's how much influence these test screenings have on films. And I know every episode I always chuck in some stupid mention of Superman 4. And again, John Cryer was in Superman 4 and he was Ducky times 100 on there. But that, you know, I mean, that film was hacked to pieces because of test screenings. And I'm not going to say it made it any better, but they took out a lot of the stuff that made it make sense. And then with this, you know, with the ending and everything, and apparently even the novelization of the film had the original ending in it. So when
do you
people...
know, I've got that on my shelf and I haven't read it for so long, I can't remember. Yeah, my husband tracked it down and bought it for me. Bless him.
What a thoughtful gift.
Yeah.
But imagine if, you know, you watched the film and then you went and bought the book and you read the book and you think, oh my God, the ending's totally different.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
And I think John Hughes hated that ending, didn't he?
Yeah.
He hated the one that they changed it to.
I suppose if you're John Hughes or any, I mean, I'm not a creative person, but if you write something and put a lot of effort into something, audiences hate it, and then the studio demands something. I suppose it must be pretty galling.
Yes.
To have that, but I don't know. We'll find out one day. I mean, some of the date that Blaine and Andy go on, he takes her to. I mean, this is one of the things, like something out of an 80s movie, where he takes her to this high school party at Steph's house, and it looks like the most debauched thing ever. I mean, these people are like 17, 18, running around in bras and pants, and everyone's drunk and all going off to each other's rooms and stuff, and you can see her being completely horrified. And the only thing I could say about Blaine there is, didn't he kind of think that might be a bit weird?
Yeah. But then he's very, very honourable there. Remember, he tries to get her to go upstairs and she thinks, oh my God, what's he taking me upstairs for? But then he's, you know, it's very much like Connell in Normal People, isn't it? He's very sort of respectful of her, and he picks up that bag of crisps and his teeth, doesn't he? I remember somehow that bit's really stuck with me. But yeah, he takes her to completely inappropriate date because he's so clueless, because I don't think he's realised how terrible his friends are until he sees them through her eyes. And there's a bit later on, there's that brilliant line, isn't there, from Steph, where Blaine says, oh, you're obsessed with money, and he says something like, if I was obsessed with money, would I really treat my parents' house like this?
Money, all that matters to you. Where the hell does that come from? Come on, look around you. Would I treat my parents' house like this if my money was any kind of issue? Well, why are you doing this? You know, why don't you just nail her and get it over with? You know, why are you getting involved?
Is there something wrong with that?
I just think it's stupid, you know, it's pointless. And your parents, I think they'll be thrilled. Mm.
Which is just one of his great lines.
Yeah.
But then I kind of do remember going to parties when I was 16 or 17, which got slightly out of hand, I think. People whose parents had big houses.
Oh, yeah.
But parties in 80s films are always like this, aren't they? It's like the one in Trading Places when Eddie Murphy invites loads of people back to his house and they're all topless within like 20 seconds.
Walk through the door and all inhibitions are left.
Yeah.
But I tell you what, for Blaine being 17, 18, I mean, he has a lot of interesting lines in this. I think after the date, when Andy wants her to take him to take her home, and he's kind of defending, saying he had a good time. He said, if I'd been in a Turkish prison with you, I'd have had a great time.
Oh, that's so romantic, isn't it? I love it.
I mean, imagine, I mean, I suppose he's seen Midnight Express, but it's a great one to think that, you know, he's, like you said, I mean, it's a good job I've seen Normal People quite recently, so I've got the Connell reference, but, you know, he's sitting there and it's this whole, you know, he's putting, he doesn't know any different, you know, that's his lifestyle, he's going to those parties and he really likes this girl, and then what do you do for a second date? Oh, you go to the stables.
I know, at the country club on a hay bale.
I wrote that down. I think it was actually a hunt club, and I found showing his political allegiances there, I think.
But the thing about Blaine is that essentially he was nice. He was the nice one. I think in those days, girls were really split. You either loved Andrew McCarthy, like me, or you loved Rob Lowe, who always played the sort of person with like a little bit of an edge of danger, you know, someone who's a bit more unpredictable. But Andrew McCarthy kind of plays the same character in this as he does in St. Elmo's Fire, the sort of slightly shy, nice boy. And a lot of teenage girls go for that, I think.
If only I'd known that information 25 years ago.
Sorry.
And who'd have thought he'd end up going out with a mannequin a couple of years later?
So. I know.
With James Spader was in that as well, actually.
Yeah, reunited.
Oh, wow. Best friends forever. And one thing I kind of identified with now watching the film, and, you know, I don't this is the thing, you know, so much time has passed. I can't say I'm a Blaine or I'm a Ducky. I'm very much more like Andy's dad. When they go home, when she goes home after the date and she's talking to the dad, you know, and she's coming up with all these very complex, almost trying to justify or go against, you know, she's, oh, but he's a Richie. You know, is it right to go out with someone because they've got money? And, you know, the dad is just, you know, for all his issues, you know, his wife's left him with a kid and he's got no job and, you know, again, literally on the wrong side of the tracks. And he's, I guess it must be difficult if you're him. I mean, it's Harry Dean Stanton is just fantastic in everything. And he's giving this advice, you know, and it's so simple when you hear it from him saying, you like him, he likes you, take the heat. It's just fantastic. And again, you know, it says a lot about me at my age now, but it must be difficult for him playing like, well, okay, I've got a teenage daughter who's obviously in love with a boy. At what
Yeah.
age? It's almost like, right, do I embrace this or do I go full sort of baseball bat at the door chasing Blaine down the road in his BMW?
And this is another reason, actually, why I think Pretty in Pink is superior to The Breakfast Club, because in The Breakfast Club, the parents are kind of faceless, aren't they? And they're all terrible. Whereas here, John Hughes has created this parent who is just a really interesting, quite complicated character. And also, Molly Ringwald has this sort of responsibility for him because he's falling apart a little bit, isn't he, after his wife has left. And so she has that added kind of carer thing going on, as well as all of the stress of being a teenager at school. And I just think that adds another layer to it, which I think is really interesting.
Yeah, I think just that there's so many pressures that, you know, it's easy to get wrong. I mean, certain people, their cultural reference of high school will be the In-Betweeners or American Pie or something like that. And, you know, there's very little nuance in any of those films. And, you know, it's easy with the nostalgia, everything. And there's this tiny little clip of while Andy's out on the date with at the stables, you see Ducky's bedroom and it's basically a mattress with a tape player. Just to make it, you know, we've already had the scene when Blaine comes out to pick Andy up for their date at the record shop, and Ducky has a bit of a, I call it a tantrum. You know, and then, you know, cuts to him sitting outside in the rain on top of a newspaper box. I mean, it's fascinating. But then you kind of think if you're a 16, 17-year-old boy and you've been turned down for a rich kid with far superior hair, then that's what you do. It's just everything about Andy's life. It seems it's like the bit where she goes to buy a dress and it's like in Pretty Woman. The posh sales assistant comes over and she sees the price tag, $650 for a dress. I assume that's a lot.
That is a lot, yeah, in the 80s, yes.
I suppose for a prom as well, that would be. And you know, you go from a $650 prom dress to what her dad has bought in a carrier bag. And I was hoping the bag would be a Happy Shopper or something like that, but he comes home and gets this carrier bag with this dress, and this is the thing, it's to him, this is like he's spent whatever money he's got on this dress for her. And you could tell, you know, she's very good at hiding the fact that she's disappointed, but she's makes something fantastic out of it.
Do you think so?
Fantastic. She's put a lot of effort in, let's say. Yeah.
Yeah,
A
full
star for
marks for
effort.
effort there,
Yeah.
Andy. Is I remember that when I first watched this when I was a kid, and you know, you're waiting for the big reveal of this dress because kind of the dresses that she has to work with are quite nice, and then there's a big reveal and it's this sort of like inverted triangle sort of monstrosity of a dress, and I remember thinking, what have you done? That's completely hideous. But as the years have gone by, I've actually learned to love it. But it's quite a Marmitey dress, I think.
It is, and I suppose that's the thing where, what was it, the episode of The Simpsons where Marge bought a Chanel dress from an outlet village and sort of bastardized it so much she couldn't do any more with it. I think that was pink as well. And this is the point where this is obviously one of Andy's skills, is to make her more unique, and you know, she makes her own clothes, she makes bits and bobs out of vintage stuff, and I suppose she's an 80s version of someone from Shoreditch. And I mean, when she turns up, you know, she goes to see Iona and but to borrow her dress that she talked about earlier, and you know, combining the two, I mean, she did quite well, but this was a proper montage. I mean, this, I was talking to a friend of mine about this, you know, in her eyes, this is a montage far superior than anything Rocky IV gave us.
But how brilliant to have, well, first of all, how brilliant to have a female as the lead character in a film. Yeah. It happens a lot less often than I would like. But also a character who's just totally individual in her taste, who doesn't want to look like everyone else, who wears things which are frequently terrible, but she likes them. I just think that's a really good role model for teenagers.
And any montage with New Order playing in the background is always good.
Yes.
But yeah, and it's, you know, this is, you know, Molly Ringwald, who, in certainly my eyes, the first lady of 80s cinema. And she's here, you know, she's the one who's basically trying to get her dad back into the real world. You know, they have to have an argument at some point. And of course it comes when she sort of says to him, but, you know, she's not coming back, she left us, you know, because I think it's not made massively clear from the beginning. You know, there might be a thought that the mum had died or something like that.
Yeah.
But then it comes out, you know, she left us, and all of a sudden it's like them two against the world.
Yeah, it's quite touching, actually.
Yeah. I mean, their relationship, you know, the fact that the first thing we see in the film, other than there was a slightly lingering shot of her putting tights on, which something for the
That's
dad.
A bit Pretty Woman as well, isn't
that
it?
That was a bit, yeah. And, you know, she's making him coffee and getting him out of bed and trying to get him into work. And I suppose if you're a young girl like that, I think she was 17 when this was made, you know, doing that as well as trying to be unique at school and dealing with, you know, bullies, really, you know, people.
Yeah, definitely.
The glam girls taking the piss out of her. She deals with a lot, but I suppose that's the strength of the film. You know, this, she isn't just some sort of doormat. This isn't, you could easily flip this love triangle onto another side and all of a sudden it's two guys competing for her attention.
Yeah.
I'd like to have seen more between Blaine and Ducky for some reason. I don't know why. Maybe, I suppose at the end they have a handshake and Ducky sort of is man enough to encourage Andy to go off with Blaine and his weird hair. But that's about as chivalrous as it gets.
Yeah. It would have been nice to have more of a lot of scenes, but actually I didn't realise until I watched it last night. This film is only about an hour and a half long, which I think was much more common in the 80s than it is now. Now, you know, loads of films seem to be 3 hours long, but they used to wrap them up a lot more quickly, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think if this was made now, this would be part of a franchise and be 3 hours long, and you'd have Samuel L. Jackson popping up at the end inviting Andy to join some sort of super club. I did like, there was, and again, the fight between Ducky and Steph. It's funny the way that, you know, this, I mean, James Spader is great. And Ducky properly sort of runs up on him and grabs him from behind, proper cheap shot. But he, you know, gives it some, you know, he's so angry that Steph has been bad mouthing his love. Unrequited love, anyway.
Yeah, it's a good fight scene, actually, because they're both sort of quite rubbish fighters.
Yeah.
And they're not doing that sort of, you know, that fake sort of Hollywood thing where they're throwing perfect punches at each other and they put a massive sound effect on it. So, you know, it sounds like they've been whacked. It's just, it's sort of the rubbish way that people actually mostly do fight.
And this is, you know, that if it was a school fight normally, you know, it would be just one of them gets the other in a headlock until the teacher comes out and separates them.
Yes.
But, you know, we get to the end and, you know, we see Andy's Frankenstein monster of a dress. So, I mean, it turns out okay. I don't know, maybe one or the other might have been better, but I suppose.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. I suppose that's the thing. You make two. I wonder what she did with the other pieces, if she made something out of those.
Yeah, maybe.
Just the fact that, you know, that they, when she arrives and there's the whole sort of lingering corridor scene, we've got Steph holding court in the prom, you know, talking about hiring a hotel suite for him and his girlfriend, and again, just a little bit more, I'm considerably richer than Yao.
Yes.
And, you know, she turns up and Ducky's there in his white shoes. I mean, they are, what's the name of those sort of cowboy type ties that Ducky likes?
Yeah, I can't remember what you call them, but yeah, it's not, it's a very individual outfit, I think. But how brave is she to turn up there by herself?
Yes.
Yeah, I can't, you know, even the thought of it makes me feel a little bit sick of having to do that. But she does it. It's
well,
great.
That's the thing, you know, part of the whole sort of routine is, you know, the boy goes to pick you up and gives you the flower and everything. And
yeah.
And she's gone there herself. I mean, you know, maybe this is, like you say, having recently watched Normal People.
This yes.
Just to make this podcast nice and current and relevant and everything else. You know, there's the whole issue there around the prom.
Yeah.
Oh my God, maybe there's more parallels than we think.
Well, you know what? I said this a while ago about Normal People and I was proved right. So I felt very smug that the BBC kept saying, you know, this is, we've made this for 16 to 24 year olds and, you know, young people will love it. And actually, when the statistics came out, the vast majority of people who are watching Normal People were over the age of 30. And it's you're watching it for nostalgia and to think, oh God, I used to feel like that. And I remember when I went out on dates like that. And so it's the same kind of thing as 80s films. You're watching it and remembering your old self.
I suppose that's the thing where, you know, I'm 40 and sit there watching it going, you know, you can quite easily transfer a lot of that into whatever school you went to and think about,
yeah.
You know, like, you know, in this film, for example, there is the issue where, like, he doesn't want to be seen to go to the prom with someone who's deemed the wrong side of the tracks or the unpopular girl or whatever, you know, however that works. And I don't know, I mean, Andy, Marianne, however that whole thing works. I mean, this is becoming a Normal People podcast. It's a good thing you're a TV writer, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Handy.
You know, coming to that, and you know, I mean, this is that Sligo and this is the United States in the 80s, very different, but there is so many things that are timeless in the whole issues around school and popularity. And you know, Blaine has to kind of, do I stay friends with a complete arsehole or do I go out with it? And in the end, he doesn't get either, and they were initially anyway. You kind of think, God, you're sort of caught between two worlds, you just
lost everything.
Sitting at the table with your coke and your weird hair. Keep calling it weird hair, but yeah, you know, rodent's probably the best way to put it.
But he does get the girl in the end. But the other slightly disappointing thing about Pretty in Pink is the snogging. There's something about those two when they kiss it. I think they only have three kisses in the whole thing. Two of them with his BMW parked perfectly behind them. And it's just, it looks a bit weird. Like somehow they don't quite have the chemistry there and they just look a little bit awkward. But maybe I've thought about that a bit too much.
I suppose it's easy to kind of put yourself in that position and think of it from there.
Mm.
If anyone's listening to this and wants to go and hunt out stuff about the original ending, I'm sure there's stuff on YouTube and whatever. But in this ending, there is, you know, the bit, like you said, you know, Ducky gets the super hot girl. And I think she doesn't have a speaking part, but she's only credited as Duckette.
Yeah.
Immediately makes
love that.
Taking her under his wing. And that was, I didn't realise, Christy Swanson, who was the original Buffy.
Yes.
It's weird. But I love, there was just that half second where he breaks the fourth wall and they kind of, wow, you know, look at me, you know.
I know.
I've done all right, yeah.
It is a great moment.
It is good to come back and think, I know that John Hughes and the original ending, but you can see why test audience wouldn't have liked it because they've spent the whole time with Ducky, you know, the bit in when he's in her bedroom and, you know, making all these sort of joke when she pops out and he's singing and talking to the dog and everything else. And if they'd ended up together, and I'm sort of saying ended up together, but had that been the ending, and I know again it was the more platonic thing, but would it have been as memorable, do you think?
No, definitely not.
Yeah.
I think I haven't watched Some Kind of Wonderful for years actually, but isn't that the one where John Hughes got to kind of fulfill that storyline and the friends ended up together? It was kind of gender swapped, so it was a girl who was sort of the best friend who was secretly in love with him, but then they did romantically end up together in the end. I think
that was it. I suppose there's a thing, like, it's easy to flip that, and I suppose it's almost like a revenge film of some sort.
Yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah.
You've got the same director, the same writer, and probably a lot of the same music and scenery and everything else. And I'll have to get around to doing that at some point because I think, I last watched that, and you kind of think, oh yeah, but he'd go off with a hot one. Showing my own issues there. But yeah, I mean, rewatching it now, and I think I've come away from it like a lot of things, you know, since I've got Spotify in the last couple of months. So many of these films that the soundtrack is fantastic, and it's one of those things where, like in Top Gun, because I recently did an episode of that about that, and they played Danger Zone about three times throughout the film. And in this, you've got Pretty in Pink by the Psychedelic Furs playing almost like a theme song throughout. You know, you've got it's not just the opening track; it goes on every time.
It's one of the, in fact, I think Rolling Stone put it in their top 20 soundtracks of all time. It's absolutely brilliant soundtrack. It's got the Smiths, Psychedelic Furs, it's got OMD. And that song at the end, If You Leave, I was reading about that the other day. They wrote it in 24 hours because the song they'd originally put forward was for the first ending. And then they needed something more upbeat for the second ending. So they just went into the studio and knocked something up from scratch. And they were saying that if you look at the prom scene at the end and everyone is dancing to If You Leave, they're slightly out of time. And it's because when they were filming it, they put on Don't You Forget About Me by Simple Minds. So then they overlaid this music on the top. So everyone's just a little bit out of step.
Okay.
I tell you what, though, if you really watch those scenes as well, Footloose is the same. If you watch the crowd scenes when people are dancing at proms and stuff like that, the 80s dancing is incredible.
There's a
Like
lot of arms being thrown
it's there is a lot of arms being waved. It's sort of really over the top moves. It's great.
there. It's fantastic, and I think, you know, everything about that, and it just shows to show, like, there's a, you know, in real life, I say real life, there's probably a lot more sort of foot shuffling and stuff. But I like just that sort of 5 6 seconds where they had the boy and the girl with their arms around each other, and the boy's arms drifted down, and the chaperone was sitting there slapping his hands away. Can imagine that. You kind of just think, you know, well, keep it pure, children, keep it pure. Bear in mind, over there, the age of consent is probably 18. So,
Oh, that's true.
on that bombshell. Well, Anita, thank you for bringing your copy of Pretty in Pink. Oh, and one
Thank you for
thing,
having me.
no, it's my pleasure. And oh, on the soundtrack, did you have it on tape or vinyl?
Tape.
Of course, something
definitely
easy.
tape. And the one thing that I didn't say was that I used to cover all the Cannes film festivals, and I went the I think the last year I went was when Drive was on,
Okay.
and I watched it, and I was totally blown away by it, and I just thought this film really reminds me of Pretty in Pink, but I'm sure I'm the only person sitting here who thinks that. And then I went to the press conference for the film with Ryan Gosling and Nicholas Winding Refn, and they said, "You know what our inspiration was for this? It was Pretty in Pink." And
Oh,
I thought,
wow.
"Yes, one of the coolest directors and actors in the world, and this is the film that they're referencing." So I felt vindicated.
I'm gonna go and have to watch Drive again. It's weird because I don't remember like a skull crushing in a lift or,
I think literally their quote was something like, "It's Pretty in Pink, but with someone getting their head smashed in,"
Okay, right,
which
okay.
is perfect, right?
Yeah, and there was neon in the credits and stuff, and it was all very.
Yeah,
Ryan
synth
Gosling has lovely.
music.
He has lovely hair.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm gonna have to rewatch that. Wow.
Please do.
I think I always got my fingers burnt with Drive because when I mean I love that film, and then when they made this film that wasn't the sequel, Only God Forgives, and I went to
Yes.
see that when I was in Finland, and I thought, okay, I'll go and watch this film, and then I didn't realize because it's set in, was it Thailand,
Yeah.
and they had a lot of things in subtitles, and of course I'm in Finland watching Thai people speaking, but of course the subtitles in Finnish. I speak a bit of Finnish, but not enough to. I'm just sitting there going, oh God, I'm confused enough as it is. I mean, that was a whole weird thing, but
I
yeah.
went to see Only God Forgives at Baby Cinema.
Oh.
And I remember hearing one of the mums saying at the beginning, "This isn't going to be a violent film, is it?" And I thought, "Oh, you've not done your homework before coming here."
God, baby cinema. Wow,
Yeah.
that's a whole novel concept. I suppose that's the thing. I think my wife took one of our kids to see one of the Star Wars recent ones when it came out, and she said, "Yeah, it was really weird. It was like the lights were on and everyone was breastfeeding, and it was great. You know, it's like well, it's something for, you know, I suppose it was only mums there. I never thought about taking the girls myself, but
No.
I might have to try that next time they bring out something uber violent. Peppa Pig goes to a Turkish prison. Oh, anyway. Anita, thank you very much for bringing this copy. We'll get it rewound and we'll see if we can pop to Tracks and see if they've started selling videos yet. Now, where can people find you on social media? And we talked about you writing about TV. Where can people find that?
So on Twitter, I'm Anita the Tweeter. And I am the entertainment editor and the TV reviewer at The Telegraph.
We normally do at the end of the podcast is play out with the song that was number one in the UK when this came out. And we did discuss this off air. This came out the same day as those awful Ewok films. So that was the 25th of April, 1986. I'd like to think that this film made more of a cultural impact than the Ewok
film. I think it did, yes.
Although we did talk about Paul Gleason earlier. He was actually in one of the Ewok films.
So, oh, was he? I didn't know that.
He was one of the, I think he was the dad that got tortured. And this was that was a really nice family film. So that one song was A Different Corner by George Michael. But what we'll do instead is, because this is the happy ending of the podcast, we haven't had to re-edit this. There wasn't a bad ending. We'll play If You Leave by OMD. Anita, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
This podcast was brought to you by executive producers Gary West, Keith Foster, Jimmy Fletcher, Mark Drakes, Matt Cunnington, Christian Dees, Chris Hopkins, Omar Zambon, Ian Madrell, Catherine Lowe, Mark Makin, Zoltan Vargo, Simon Smith, Laurie Curran, Wayne McNally, Darren Hodgkins, Dan Wellington, Alex Heal, Philip Rothenberger, Alan Viewings, Tom Carr, James Kennedy, Simon Pegg, Joe Harrison, Anita Singh, associate producer Chris Oakley. Visit patreon.com/Betamax Video Club for more information about bonus episodes, early access, discounted merchandise, and more.